Hi, everybody. Today is Thursday, April 24th, 2025, and our friends Richard Wolf and Michael Hudson are back with us. Welcome back.
Good to be here.
Good to be here.
Starting with what's going on between the United States and China, here is what Donald Trump said.
Conversation started with China.
Are you going to play hardball with them? Are you going to mention COVID?
I'm not going to mention COVID. I'm not going to say, oh, I'm going to play hardball with China. I'm going to play hardball with you, President Xi. No. We're going to be very nice. They're going to be very nice. And we'll see what happens. But ultimately, they have to make a deal because otherwise, they're not going to be able to deal in the United States. And we want them involved. But they have to, and other countries have to make a deal. And if they don't make a deal, we'll set the deal. Because we're the ones that set the deal. Scott and Howard and myself and others, we're going to be setting the deal. And it'll be a fair deal for everybody. And it'll be, I think it's a process that's going to go pretty quickly. China was taking us for a ride and just not going to have, it's not going to happen. We're going to be very good to China. I have a great relationship with President Xi, but they would make billions and billions and billions of dollars a year, and they would build their military out of the United States and what they made, so that won't happen. But they're going to do very well, and I think they're going to be happy, and I think we're going to live together very happily and ideally work together. So I think it's going to work out very well.
And China's foreign ministry has officially denied reports from Washington suggesting that active consultation or a potential agreement of tariffs are currently underway. Michael, let's get started with you. Has Trump caused irreversible changes in world trade and investment?
Well, it turns out that this whole idea of imposing radical tariffs is all about the Cold War with China. Trump says he has 3 months to negotiate with other countries, making a deal. I'll agree not to disrupt your trade and investment, cause you bankruptcies, if you will agree not to trade with China, and in fact, to impose sanctions on trade with China. You'll do to China what we asked Europe to do to Russia. You will forego the prospects of increasing trade with the most rapidly growing economies of China, Russia, and Asia. If you agree to that, then we'll roll back your tariffs to only 10%. That'll cause just a little pain with you. And also, Trump is telling them to talk to his chairman of economic advisors, Stephen Miron, and says, well, we want you to really bear the costs of the Cold War. Remember, we're protecting you against the threat of having to trade with China and let China invest in your infrastructure and develop the roads and the railroads in order to have trade. In order to fight them, it's cost money, and you're going to have to pay, just as Europe and Germany's agreed to pay. Now, remember, Germany's been willing to stop oil and gas trade with Russia and dismantle its industry just to support the Cold War. We want you to do that. And if you don't agree to that in the next 3 months, then we're not going to refrain from imposing our tariffs of 40% or so. This is nonsense. And Trump is, not only Trump, but the U.S. Congress has outlined exactly what this deal is going to be that's going to make China so much money. It's going to reduce trade on non-national security items, the tariffs, to maybe 30%, but 100% on any trade that has anything to do with national security. Well, the footnote is, everything is national security. And it's up to Congress, and especially the committee that is staffed with China haters, to decide exactly what's national security. So what is being offered to China is economic suicide, basically, and a lose-lose deal. There's absolutely no chance of that happening at all. And you can see the fight that's going on this week in Washington at the International Monetary Fund and World Bank meetings. All of the Chinese officials who are dealing with international finance and international trade are there. There haven't been any meetings reported with U.S. officials at all. There have been a lot of Chinese statements saying that they are not going to negotiate at gunpoint and under threats. They're only going to talk among equals. I don't see China making any deal at all with the United States, or even seriously talking, until the 3 months are over of Trump's negotiations with other countries. And if China sees that the U.S. is trying really to draw an iron curtain against China, then obviously it's going to go right ahead with not only with its tariffs on U.S. exports, but more important, its refusal to export commodities that are critical for the American national security, meaning the military, like the rare earth metals and all sorts of computer chips and others. The sanctions against trade with high technology that is critical for military spending, for the creating a monopoly in information technology goods. All of this really is more in control of China than the United States. So it looks to me like the United States has nothing to offer except threats, and the opening demands of Trump, in his usual ways, make a huge demand that is a mind expansion for the adversary country. And they're so surprised at how absurd and crazy and destructive this demand is, that then Trump can say, okay, well, let's talk about how we can cut it back. Having established a ridiculous demand as his opening gambit, China's just going to walk right away. I don't see it negotiating at all. When you look at how the stock market has sort of recovered, as if, we can all go back to normal as we did on Monday, and the stock market's gone up 5%, while the dollar's gone down 6% since Trump took office, there's an idea that all of this is reversible, that Trump's disruption of international trade is can all be sort of reversed. And it's as if now he's seen the light, and to look at the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times, it's as if everything that when Trump said he'll reappoint the head of the Federal Reserve, Powell, that everybody sighed with relief. But it has nothing to do with the Federal Reserve. It's all about the Cold War and China. And this is the point that China's making, is precisely that. And that is almost unthinkable for the U.S. press and even for Congress and for the government to think about it. So it looks to me like this dream world of seeming recovery, everything is going to be restabilized, is going to be is going to be lost. Later, I can explain exactly what I think is going to happen and what all of the strains are. But that's the big picture.
Well, for me, the first way to comment on this is to retell the old story of the protection racket. You know, the two tough guys in trench coats who come into the little dry cleaning establishment somewhere in the city and inform the proprietor that they're there to collect the $200 a week of protection money. And the proprietor looks at them, having never seen them before, and says, "What do I need protection from?" Laughing. And they say, "Well, you need it from us, because if you don't give us the money, your establishment will burn down early next week. So you can pay protection or not." Then Mr. Trump, in the clip you just showed us, tell us that either they make a deal or we will set the deal and we will be fair. In other words, the world is supposed to do what the United States thinks is fair. The United States thought it was fair to move NATO right up to Russia's borders over the last 10 years. That didn't work out real well. It turns out other people's notion of fair is not the same as yours. Most adults have figured that out by the time they reach adulthood. That's why you have to work things out. You can't just threaten people and assume that they will therefore allow your definition of fair to stand. That mentality, which mistakes power for something having to do with fairness, which needs to cover the exertion of power with a veneer of fairness, that reminds me of the last 80 years of the American Empire, which covered over its power moves by claiming that it was bringing democracy to everybody. I mean, that is not going to fool anyone anymore. It's amazing that it fooled anyone ever anyhow. So the problem here is the United States is frustrated. It hasn't been able to utilize its power in the present the way it in fact was in the past. I hate to keep going back to the end of World War II, but the second half of the 20th century was a very special time in which the United States emerged from World War II, the only dominant economic, political, ideological, and military power. That was an extraordinary situation. Had not existed in the world for quite some time. Even the British Empire wasn't as totally dominant, having not come out of a world war the way the American did. And it was only a matter of time, which anyone looking at the situation would have known, and there were voices who said this as early as the 1940s. "This is an odd situation," those voices said. Even George Kennan, who was enthusiastic about the American Empire, kept warning people that the control of the Soviet Union was not going to be easy, and you better contain them, otherwise your dominance is going to be threatened. And they followed his advice because somewhere they also knew that when you're the dominant power, you also become Hegel's contribution of contradiction, you also become highly vulnerable because everybody else dominated by you begins to try to undo your domination. It's the master-slave dichotomy. The slave is the slave of the master, and the master then becomes the slave of the condition of having a slave. It's a very old understanding. It's a shame that people don't study Mr. Hegel the way previous generations did to their benefit. All right, having said that, let me deal with your question. I'm going to strongly state what Mr. Trump has done has irreducibly and irreversibly altered the global economic situation. It's too late now. He's done the damage. How he manages the damage and how his successors manage the damage, that's more open. But let me briefly summarize the damage. every country on this planet and every company that either buys from or sells to the United States, and that is many, many companies in every country across the world, has now undertaken, it's already done, a rethinking of their business model, of their plans, of their investments. And the reason is simple. The United States has shown the world that it is dangerous to depend on the United States. For anything you buy, for anything you sell, their political leaders, and by the way, this includes the Democrats, who by their silence seem to be more or less not the enemies of what Mr. Trump is doing, adopting rather a wait and see. If it works out, we won't oppose it because it's not politically cute for us to do. So the rest of the world sees Mr. Trump, without meaningful domestic opposition yet, able to what? Well, let's look at what Michael just said, to hurt them. To hurt them with a 10% tariff, a 20% tariff, sanctions maybe, if not sanctions on them, sanctions on people who do business with them. This is a whole-scale attack on them. It hurts them. It reduces their profits. It thereby reduces the taxes they pay to their own governments. I could go on. If they have made a unilateral decision that leads every country and every company to start looking much more intensely at finding alternative sources of inputs and imports to those countries, and alternatives to the United States as an export market. Just out of the logic of profit maximization and the logic of risk minimization, which are the rules of capitalist businesses. And they're not going to change that unless there were a virtual revolution in the United States in which an alternative political leadership emerged that clearly and powerfully had an alternative plan that didn't involve tariffs, sanctions, and there is no such thing.
Well, Richard, you've made the point very eloquently, and I agree with it all. And the way you describe it, in this protection racket, whose house is really going to burn down? Let's look at in the case of Europe in the United States. Whose house burned down? Well, it turned out to be Germany and Europe's house that's burning down. Will the global South and global majority countries and the BRICS look at this and say, we don't want to suffer the same fate that Germany and other countries did? We have to look at the long term, and the long term is that the United States is going into a depression. Goldman Sachs and the IMF are agreement that it just came into that. They're looking at the fact that the dollar is going to continue to go down another 5 to 10% on top of the 5 to 6% it's already gone down under Trump. That means that countries have foreign investment in the United States, however much they make in interest, or however much they make in dividends, or even capital gains, is being wiped out by the degree to which the dollar is going down. And that is exactly what Trump says is his objective. And again, his Council of Economic Advisors say, well, other countries have to bear the cost of this Cold War against China. And this war is all to prevent you countries from dealing with China. And you have to bear the costs of our military fighting all over the world to help isolate China. This is so heavy a long-term cost that I don't think these countries are going to say, well, we're going to live in the short term. We're politicians. Politicians live in the short run. We want to keep the U.S. market in the short run. So don't raise your tariffs. We will give up the next 20, 30, or 50 years of our development in order to have another years of agreement with the United States. No one can really do that. Or, of course, you can have leaders like Merz in Germany and the other European leaders who, like France and England, who can do it, but they'll be voted out of power very quickly. So this is the instability that I see. You've seen in the last few weeks Scott Bessent has gone to Argentina and Latin American countries telling them don't trade with China. He's put a special pressure on Argentina because he said, we want to use you as a military base to control Antarctica. If Russia is trying to control the Arctic, we want to control Antarctica. And we are going to try to, make you loans, but we want you to stop trading with, there's already pressure, stop trading with China. Well, Argentina trades as much with China as it does with the United States. And despite the fact that Milei is a right-wing neoliberal, he's so far balked at the U.S. Demands for that. Well, what this shows is what the Cold War is really all about. It's not simply the United States against China, is the rest of the world going to be neoliberal, pushing a privatization of government as if the world's run by Elon Musk, cutting off government and turning it all over to the 1% in the financial sector to buy up? Or is the rest of the world going to follow the road that made China rich by creating a socialist mixed public-private economy? Well, that's the only way for any nation to industrialize. You keep natural monopolies, transportation, communication, and especially money and banking as public utilities in the public domain to provide services at subsidized prices or freely to help the economy grow. That's the opposite philosophy that from the United States, which is short-termism, turning almost all of the gains in wealth to the 1%, not trying to raise living standards and productivity for the 99%, which is China's aim. That's really what all of this is about. So what's this is the context for what's happening. And again, I can talk about China's strategy for all of this, but China realizes this. There's no friendly talk between President Xi and other Chinese diplomats and the United States. For the first time, that I can remember, Chinese diplomats have spoken very rudely to the United States and said, look, we're just not going to talk on these terms. I think that's going to be the future. And it's not even about tariffs anymore. It's about China's refusal to make exports of key products to the United States that the United States military and the information technology, computer technology needs in order to operate. So we're really seeing a breakdown in world trade and investment that's going to be the opportunity for a restructuring of world trade. And as just as you said, Richard, other countries are saying, which direction do we want to go? We're being forced to go in one or the other. The United States is trying to block us from into dependency on it. And we've all seen that you can't depend on Trump, because once you give into him on the first demand that he makes, as in the case of law firms and his attack on universities, he'll then make another demand. And no matter what Trump would promise China, and Congress would oppose it because Congress is dominated right now just as much as Trump, with just as much an anti-Chinese policy, realizing it's all about what kind of economic and social structure the world's going to have. Will it be, will they follow the Chinese model or the US neoliberal model? Will they follow, will they end up like Germany and Europe, or will they find end up more like China?
Richard, I think the question would be, what would be the path forward for the United States and China?
Well, let me say a word about Europe to take it a little step further. The second half of the 20th century and the first 20 years of this one have seen the leadership of Europe mostly dominated by what we call center-right political figures. And they have had one basic theme, that the United States is wonderful and the protector of everybody, and the evil is the Soviet Union, and now the evil is Russia. That our policy is self-protection. We're protecting you all, say these right-wing leaders to their own people. Vote for us because we are the bosom buddies of the United States, lined up via NATO to confront and contain the Soviet Union, now Russia. This policy is now dead. The United States has said to the whole of Europe, you can be anti-Russian if you like, but we're not playing anymore. We're not going to do all of this. We're not going to fight Russia in Ukraine anymore, etc., etc. That left the Europeans in power with half of a policy. Being close to the United States, they couldn't do anymore because the United States was saying that the war in Ukraine was over or a mistake or a failure. So what they're left with is pure anti-Russianism. It's pathetic to watch. This is when you're riding half a bicycle. You know what happens if you ride half a bicycle? You fall over. You may take a few moments, but you're going to fall over because you need two, and you only got one. The right wing in Europe is desperate. Pay attention to how they talk. You can see it. Their whole policy is ferocious anti-Russianism, which is why they line up behind Zelensky and other odd choices. But here's an important point that comes from what Michael just said about Argentina. While they're doing all this, they are in fact more and more dependent on China. The Europeans need to cultivate China. And I think if you see now the decision to move their assets and invest heavily in military production at the expense, therefore, of the European standard of living, because what else can they do? You're setting up conditions for what Michael said, for a rapid, sharp, left-wing shift of power in Europe. The conditions for it, the political parties to articulate, are all in place. What has to happen is a recognition, particularly by the business communities there, that just like in Argentina, they don't want to lose the business with China, which is crucial. The same is true for the actual and the potential business of Europe in China, which the difficulties with the United States ironically make more urgent for Europe than they were before. They are among the countries I referred to before that are rethinking and have to. And if the right-wing leadership is too compromised to do it, then the left-wing leadership will become attractive to the business community, which will oppose it less than they used to. And that's probably all the left there needs to come into power. How they will use such a power, I don't know. I don't think they do either. But you can see the reorganization of the world economy that Nima is asking is happening for Europe as well, because they are not immune to everything, everything that we have been saying. Apropos of the strategy towards China, at least for the last 15 years and maybe longer, the policy of the United States has been regime change in China, not just in Russia, in China. They would like China to be a cooperative, subordinate, but powerful member of the community of capitalist nations. That's what they would like. And they've taken many steps, and they've said that over and over again. The standard story in Washington that I hear from the people I know there, because of my education, I know a lot of these people. They were my schoolmates and so on, has always been the same. Get, quote, China to be a proper member of the community of nations. That's why we brought them into the World Trade Organization. That's why Kissinger and Nixon went there in the first place in the 1970s. And we have had to vary our policy, but that's what we want. They should become more and more private in their hybrid mix of private and state enterprises. They should therefore become more dependent on monetary and fiscal policy rather than the more direct interventions that they practice in their economy. And that's all. Now they want to use tariffs, because the other mechanisms of pressuring them in that direction failed. It didn't work. And it's clear they are not about to work either. They've become too rich too fast and too big too fast. You haven't got levers of power over them. Okay, now you're going to use, here comes the desperation again. You're going to use the last big club you have to get them to do that. And they're letting you know, by everything Michael just said, they're not going to do it. It's not going to work. You waited too long. You might have tried this 30 years ago, but not now. Not now. Can't do it now. Too late. And if you look at the Chinese, not only in terms of what they've done in their country, but having crafted, and I mean crafted, the BRICS as an allied nations, wow, that is an extraordinarily crucial. Because where will China go if they can't trade with the United States? If Mr. Trump carries it through and really does isolate them? The answer is the BRICS. That's their first defense, to reorganize their imports and exports, which those BRICS countries will be having to do too, both sides having to reconnect out of the U.S. into their own. I read a speech the other day, I believe, of the Treasury Secretary, in which he advises the Chinese, by the way, the arrogance is overwhelming, but he advises the Chinese to be less export dependent and to do more to develop their internal market. Well, only a person who has no idea what the Chinese have been doing for 20 years would say such a thing, because they've been doing that for 20 years. That's why the real wages in China have gone up 4 times over the last 25 years, while America's real wages have been stagnant for the same 20 years. There it is. Of course, they're building their domestic, but they also have allies. They don't actually have to depend totally on their domestic, because they really have allies. And the tariffs, by being uniform, are pushing all their allies to work closer with China to become a self-sufficient world economic power. And since they are now larger than the West, that they have more of a power base, economically speaking, than the West does, and they have shown the capability of doing the most advanced technological breakthrough, you are looking at a split world economy where the odds are better for China to come out on top of that than for the United States. And all the make-believe in the world isn't going to change that.
Well, here's the problem. When you're talking about the need for a Europe to have a left-wing swing in order to survive. But there's the only left-wing party that I've seen in Germany is Sarah Wagenknecht's party. And she either by voter manipulation or otherwise did not meet the 5%. Right. She was just below the 5% limit to get into Congress. In order for Europe to take a left-wing swing, they need an ideology. Now, of course, you and I have been spending our lives trying to provide exactly that kind of logic for how do you develop an economy that's going to work. And it's what we have to use the word socialism to say that, because it involves a government strong enough to prevent a creditor financial oligarchy from developing and doing to the economy what it's done to the United States and Western Europe, deindustrializing it, financializing it, making the path to wealth a form of making financial gains, not industrial gains, not labor productivity gains, not developing the internal market. There's the internal ideology. And this is a problem not only for Europe, but I think for many BRICS countries. Many of these countries are not left-wing, some are outright right-wing. How are you how are you and I guess we're the main people who are trying to promote this, how are we to spread this ideology, the idea of how to create a development plan that is going to develop? Well, look at the contrast between what you and I are talking about, a left-wing plan, and what Trump is saying. Trump is saying all we need to do to reindustrialize the United States is to have tariffs. Well, he said, look at the 19th century. Well, as we've spoken before in this program, tariffs worked because the United States had very active government investment in railroads, communications, and social spending to create a high wage, high productivity labor force. This is not what Trump intends to accompany his protective high tariff rates that really are not protective, because there's no industry to protect, and it's very hard to see how the United States can develop an industry. Well, apply this to the third world countries. How are they going to develop, not only by trade with China, but by restructuring their economy along the same lines that made the United States an industrial power in the 19th century, Germany an industrial power in the 19th century, all with active government investment and what was called by almost all parts of the political spectrum, from the left to the right, socialists. John Stuart Mill, the free marketer, called himself a socialist. Many Christians founded a Christian socialist party. Even the Catholics had Catholic socialism. There was anarchic socialism, not only Marxian socialism, but all sorts of communitarian, communalist socialism. That has become such a politically a word that it just triggers American opposition, and it's almost as if the McCarthyism that you've seen today when it comes to talking about Russia or China as a third rail, you're almost seeing this in global South countries and the BRICS countries. So the big question is, for these changes to take place, it requires more than just trading with China. It requires going along with creating an infrastructure. Well, that's just what China's promising to do in its Belt and Road. It begins by saying, well, you're going to have transportation infrastructure. You're going to have to develop your economy in along these lines. And the advantage that China has over the United States is it is not necessarily taking its payments in the way that the U.S. bondholders do. It's not saying you have to pay us in dollars or our currency. You pay us in kind. Either we will take an equity position in the infrastructure that we create, and we'll only take what is actually the returns for this, or we'll take our payments in the products that you're producing. They're not using the investment as a lever to force them into debt and into reliance on the International Monetary Fund that pushes anti-labor, right-wing development plans on everything. So the issue is not simply trade with China. It's creating a whole full-fledged alternative to the International Monetary Fund and World Bank and the economic structure that the United States imposed after World War II in its own interest to essentially concentrate all the wealth in its own hands, instead of having other countries use their wealth to improve their capital, their public investment, their infrastructure, and all the capital investment that's needed to really industrialize and raise living standards and productivity.
Let me respond, Nima, because I think there's an important point here. I agree with Michael. The BRICS countries are very heterogeneous, left wing, right wing, no question about that. They're not all China, not by a long shot, et cetera, et cetera. But let me spell out a scenario, and it's only a possibility. I don't believe in predicting the future. I'm not telling anyone what I'm about to describe is going to happen. But I am telling you it might happen. And here is the reason I think so. It comes out of American history. When Franklin Roosevelt, early in the Depression, ran for president, he ran as a middle-of-the-road conventional Democrat. He advocated a balanced budget, even in the middle of the kind of crash that he was living through at the whole country. He went to the left because the mass of people went to the left in the United States. Huge numbers joined two socialist and one communist party, and they all together mobilized and were the militants of the CIO, which was the greatest unionization drive in all of American history, before or since. Okay, they then went to Mr. Roosevelt and said, you have to move to the left with us or we're voting you out of office. You're not going to stay here. And he understood the argument. They had mobilized millions of people. They could control those votes. He'd be out. His political future finished. So he went with them out of opportunism, no question about it. But what did he do? He created then, under the pressure from below, Social Security, which we never had before, a government pension program, a minimum wage, which we never had before, an unemployment compensation program at the federal level, which we'd never had before. And he hired 15 million people on the government payroll, which we had never had before. Spectacular changes. Okay, Why am I telling you this? Because if we now, at the end of the desperate gestures of Mr. Trump, generate a global inflation slash recession, or the stagflation that more and more are contemplating is coming, we may well have what Michael referred to before when he had a slip. He meant the word recession, if you heard at the beginning of the program, but out came depression. Yeah, exactly. There's more wisdom there than there is a slip of the tongue. Okay, what's going to happen? The mass of people are going to go to the leaders of the BRICS countries and say, we now need salvation from stagflation. The United States is the cause. China might be the solution. And out of that would come what I described before, an accommodation, despite center-right or other leaders in BRIC. They would either have to accommodate the way Roosevelt had to, or they'd have to get out of the way, because other forces will make that claim. I don't think that's fanciful anymore. Do I say it's going to happen for sure? Of course not. I can't predict the future any better than anybody else can, which is to say we cannot. But is that a possibility emerging here? Absolutely. It is a possibility, and it is a possibility that would address obstacles to the process that's already underway, but that the United States wants to hold back, to prevent, even to reverse. That it cannot do, and that makes this scenario possible in the future, despite the heterogeneity of BRICS governments, their difference from the Chinese, and so on. And I wouldn't discount it. I think you're seeing, I'm amazed at how fast everything is going. There are now in the mainstream of the American financial press constant stories. There were half a dozen this morning before I came into our program here, in which the decline of the dollar, the decline of the dollar as a safe haven, the decline of U.S. treasuries as a safe haven. Here we are in a period of turmoil. Here we are with an imminence of recession. And where is the money going? Not into the dollar. It's not the safety. It's not the riskless asset that it used to be. This is a momentous shifting of the whole flow of short and medium-term capital around the world, responding to the kind of change that you, Nima, at the beginning of today, asked us to talk about.
Well, it turned, in my view, the decline of the dollar is the key catalyst to all of this change. My whole theory of super imperialism that I developed in 1972 was, when the United States went off gold, it left other central banks with only one alternative to hold their international savings. And that was loans to the U.S. Treasury in the form of spending their dollars that the United States was throwing off, mainly by its military spending abroad. They recycled it in the United States to essentially, the effect was to give the United States a free ride. Using the dollar as the form of other people's savings enabled the United States to spend a constant balance of payments deficit, largely military, structuring the world along the lines that it wanted. Well, why did other countries do it? If France and Germany and other payment surplus countries, and later China, did not spend their dollar, their foreign trade and balance of payment surpluses back into the United States, their currencies would rise against not only the dollar, but other countries whose currencies were traded in dollars, and therefore their exports had become less competitive because of financial purely financial factors, not productivity factors, but purely the exchange rate factors. Once countries break away, once the United States takes the lead in dismantling this whole key that has been the buttress of America's Cold War spending and super imperialism, once this key goes, there goes the whole means of financing the American balance of payments deficit. And imagine what would happen if the United States no longer had the free ride of other countries using their economic savings and surpluses from supporting the U.S. balance of payments and treasuries. That America would have to do what England had to do when it lost its empire. It would have to raise interest rates very sharply to support its exchange rates. It would lose the free lunch that it had been getting from controlling the sterling area. It would all of a sudden have to rely on its own internal resources, and yet it had dissipated these resources by thinking, oh, we don't have to industrialize. We can just depend on other countries financing us because we've structured the sterling area and the payment system to do this. Well, America broke up that system of the sterling area and also the French franc area in 1945 at the end of World War II. But now the United States faces the prospect of turning itself into England. And what if it has to rely on its own domestic productive capacity when it's already deindustrialized it by offshoring its industry to China and other Asian countries in order to have cheaper labor costs instead of hiring U.S. labor as part of the class war of American industry and the financial sector against labor? This is the whole problem. This is where all of this is ending. This is the horror story of what would happen to turn America into having to pay its own way and being just another country instead of the recipient of the world's savings. And yet this seems to be the stated objective of the Trump administration and Vance and the Council of Economic Advisors to lower the dollar's exchange rate. Well, the only solution for that has been the Trump administration's suggestion, let other countries buy 100-year U.S. government bonds and see what they'll get after 100 years when the dollar continues to decline, unless it can somehow become a different economy than it is. That's the real question. When all of these changes take place and this realignment of world trade and investment with China that we've been talking about, when that occurs, will the United States have to restructure its own economy? And somehow that would end the Cold War fight between neoliberal financialized economies centered in the United States and Europe and pro-labor, pro-investment, pro-growth economies following the Chinese Asian model, which itself is reinventing the wheel that the United States and Germany developed in the 19th century and British mercantilism long before that in the 18th century.
You know, it reminds me, this conversation, what we're doing is we're telling a story in which profit-maximizing behavior by capitalists leads them to take steps which then come back and undermine their ability to profit-maximize. In other words, that the system has built into it fundamental contradictions, and those can be postponed, those can be deferred, but they don't go away, and they will one day, when the conditions vary, come right back up and bite you. You know, it reminds me early in Marx's Capital, he makes an observation, which I remember reading and being stunned by. It goes, in modern English, it would go like this. Every capitalist is told, minimize your labor costs. Minimize, you know, replace your workers with machines. Replace expensive workers with cheap workers. Replace, you know, and on and on and on. And then he points out, but of course, this profit-making, maximizing strategy of minimizing your wage bill comes back to bite you because it's the workers' wages which enable them to buy back what you're trying to sell. And their inability to do that will be as depressing on your profitability as pumping down their wages was. If the conditions vary, this could come back and be a disaster, this program of minimizing your wages. That's what we're doing now. We're explaining how moving production out of the United States, becoming the financialized sector, whether we apply it to the role of London in the collapse of the British Empire or the role of the United States in the collapse of its empire, is an example where the pursuit of profits, negative, its contradictory implications come back and overwhelm the system. And that's usually a moment of crisis for the system. And in moments of crisis, big shifts occur. Hence my proposal or idea that both for Europe now, but for the whole BRICS conglomerate, moments of truth are getting closer and closer as the United States takes more extreme measures to make the world pay for its empire or for the survival of its empire. It provokes the world to say, wait a minute, this doesn't work for us. This is too dangerous, too costly. And we have an option. And that option may mean we have to get into bed with the Chinese. However uncomfortable that makes us feel, that's our only way out here.
Yeah.
Profits are made by industrial firms, and industrial firms, at least under industrial capitalism, reinvest their profits in building more factories and more means of production to hire more labor, and that's increasing. But today, I don't think the aim is to make profits anymore. It's to make capital gains by financial engineering that are financed by debt leveraging, borrowing money to take over companies and deindustrialize them, and economic rents. Trump and the Democrats especially have said the ideal is to create America as a rentier, rent-seeking economy, and the rents that we're seeking are monopoly rents primarily. And these monopoly rents that we're really trying to get is an information technology, high-tech computer chips, computerization. And if we can block China from having access to being able to sell its computer chips and its information technology system abroad, and then we can make other countries dependent on our information technology. And if we do that, then we can threaten to cut them off from this technology if they don't follow the U.S. Diplomatic directives, just as we once used agricultural sanctions to try to starve countries into following U.S. demands. Well, China realizes this, and it's already taken the step to stop this by stopping its exports of rare earth metals and the other computer chip technology that is absolutely essential for the American and European and actually anybody else's ability to create a monopoly in information technology without spending 5 years or even more with a huge environmental costs to create refinery production in their own country to create not only the rare earth metals, but all sorts of long-term planning and research and development that China has been spending its economic returns on to invest in. And the United States has fallen behind, not only so much in its dependency on its ability to on products from raw materials to computer technology that comes from China, that it is unable to compete within the next 5-year time frame. And China China doesn't have to do anything at all except what it's already done in the last month or two, saying that we are not going to provide the United States with the materials that it needs to create a monopoly to fight us and try to divide the world into countries that are dependent on U.S. high-tech exports and Chinese exports. The Chinese are ahead in robotization, in factory design, in almost just as Russia and China are ahead in military weaponry from American technology. So America is no longer in the position that we've talked about it had in 1945. It's become a laggard country, and the laggard country is because it's financialized, not seeking profits by seeking financial gains that have been made by deindustrializing the rest of the economy, and it's and trying to replace industrial profits with monopoly rents, with land rents for real estate by untaxing real estate, by natural resource rents, by rent seeking. Just the essentially, this is what industrial capitalism was supposed to free markets from, these legacies of feudalism, a landlord class, a monopoly class, and a predatory banking class. All of that is coming back under the leadership of the United States, leaving other countries. It's ironically China with socialist characteristics. You could just as well say China with industrial capitalist characteristics based on profits made by improving the internal market and raising labor productivity, which was the original the plan of capitalism as outlined by Adam Smith and all of the classical free market economists of the 19th century.
Yeah.
One last word to show the danger that we're in. If Michael is right, if the United States is hell-bent on cashing in on its only way forward, namely to be a monopolist of a certain set of things and siphon the surplus from the rest of the world, because they won't be able to do industrial production without the monopolized mechanisms or means to do it, and that the money will come in, rather like London was able to siphon surplus from the rest of the world as its empire declined. We still have to notice that being a monopolist in the end is not a way to employ 330 million Americans, and that the whole AI revolution and the whole Musk wholesale firing of federal employees is a symbolic taste of where this is taking the United States, because the gap between rich and poor, between urban and rural, between skilled and educated on the one hand and not on the other, those are becoming extreme dichotomies. And that might be sustainable for a while if you had been used to it for hundreds of years. But the United States for the last century has celebrated itself as a middle class society in which everybody is entitled to get the quote American dream. That's over. And that will become harder and harder to sustain and will turn people at first to the first demagogue who cashes in on it by the name of Trump, but there will be others from the left as well as the right who are going to speak to that condition, and that raises a whole new set of contradictions for the way this is evolving.
Absolutely right. I don't see these new politicians coming from the Democratic Party.
No.
Thank you so much, Richard and Michael. Great pleasure, as always.
Okay, good conversation.
Yes, I loved it.
Very good.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Take care.